So I have I take refuge in Sangha, the interdependence of all creations. I find myself immediately thinking about a conversation between the Buddha and his assistant, his cousin for many years, Ananda, when Ananda came to the Buddha and said, "You know, I think that spiritual friends, having good spiritual friends, is half of practice." And the Buddha said, "No, Ananda. Having good spiritual friends is the whole of the practice." So that conversation sort of echoes with me when I think about how we all need encouragement and we all need help in our quest to open and to release. So the statement acknowledges that we all grow together in Sangha, that we grow together in developing kindness, compassion, and generosity. You know, refuge is traditionally defined as taking shelter from danger. And the third of the three refuges after Buddha and Dharma, the presence of all things and the teaching of harmony of all things, that refuge may seem like something new, a new idea, but the truth is that it's not unusual. We've always done it. All of us have done it. Where do you go in your mind when you feel stressed? Where do you go in your mind when you feel threatened or challenged? As a child, probably to your parents, maybe to someone you love, maybe to an enduring memory. Or a beloved teacher in your mind, a place of peace and tranquility and safety. So, what I'm saying is that refuge is not a new idea in our lives. And what the three refuges really call us to do is to sort of consciously sharpen our vision of what is refuge and how we can use it in our lives. So this study of the three refuges is an attempt to focus on refuge and allow us to take refuge in a conscious way as we make choices about how we live our lives. As mature persons, living this life that we've been given, but doing it with an awareness that allows us to see what we do and how we do it. That, I think, is what the precepts call us to do. So, living by the precepts is similar to the 12-step method, which I think some of you are probably familiar with. It's a reckoning. It's a reckoning with the complications and difficulties of adult life. It involves an inventory of how we are in the world as we focus on our innermost wish of how we want to live and what we want to do. How we want to be with others. And sometimes it's hard to see. We are often resistant. That study of the precepts requires honest self-examination, which is sometimes difficult, but it leads ultimately to relief and a simplification of your life. And the key to understanding the precepts and letting the precepts penetrate your life is the activity, or maybe I should call it the non-activity, of meditation, of zazen, as it provides the opportunity for us to settle on ourselves from the inside, not as a response to all the input and stimulation we are constantly bombarded with. All of us, but from the inside, something that is generated from our innermost wish. So how do we find this settling, this resolve from the inside? We find it with the help and support of Sangha. And Sangha, I want to point out, differs from other groups that we may be members of. Sangha, very interestingly, is not necessarily based on friendship. It's not necessarily based on people you like. You might even be in Sangha with people you don't like. Sangha is based on wanting to be real with other people. So even if you don't like all those in your Sangha, our relations still revolve around seeking honest and undefended communication. Preferences of being liked or of not liked or of liking aren't really necessary. We go beyond those preferences in Sangha. Sometimes Sangha is compared to, and I like this image, of a rock tumbler. You know, one of these machines that you put a rock in and it sort of, you know, tumbles it around. Because in a rock tumbler, rocks with sharp edges go into the tumbler, sharp corners, and as they tumble, they become soft. And that's what hopefully happens to us in practice. That as we practice self-acceptance and acceptance of others together, we soften, we open. You know, I recall coming to Zen Center in my own experience in the early 70s. And there was a strong emphasis on including everyone all the time. And it was something I had never really experienced before. In the 60s, I spent a winter on a kibbutz in Israel. And the kibbutz was a wonderful experience for me in a lot of ways. But the wonderful experience was mostly about work. And it was about sharing the facilities. The kibbutz was big. I'm sure there are small ones where there's personal interaction, but there I really didn't find that. And then another experience I had in Sangha was in the 70s, 60s and the 70s, I was very involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and perhaps I was naive, but in the end, it felt to me like it was a reflection in a lot of ways of the dominant society and the values of the dominant society. And what I mean by that is that people related in ways that were often manipulative and secretive and had agendas that weren't put out front. And somehow I expected more from the counterculture that was rejecting the dominant culture. But in the end, I felt disappointed. And that's about the time that I found Zen practice. And what I found, and I think this changes. I mean, impermanence applies to Zen centers too. You know, it's not just everything else. And what I found at Zen practice was that there was this enormous emphasis to include everyone, not to exclude anyone. People asked, how do I join? And the answer was, just show up. And you're a member. So Zen practice was refreshing to me, this notion of including everyone who wanted to be included. And I think one of the things for me about everyday Zen that Norman has created with all of us is, again, this openness, this feeling that if you show up, you're a member. If you show up, you're part of the dynamic and the direction of the community. And it's not, again, people don't have to agree on everything. It's curious to me in looking back at Zen history that in the Tang Dynasty in the 7th century, 8th century China, Buddhist monasteries often took in monks of different lineages and different persuasions, and they practiced together. I might add, mostly probably in silence, but they practiced together, And they lived together in harmony. They worked together, and they would come together for, as it worked then in the winter time when it was too dangerous to travel, it was too wet, it was too muddy. They would come together, and for 3 months they would practice intensively, like we still do at Tassajara or Green Gulch. And then they would go their own way, but they didn't always agree on basic principles, but they came together and practiced together. So Sangha is, to me, a community organized around intention. Intention, the basis being to be real to yourself and to be real to others. Not to pass time in conversation, not to have a, it's not a cocktail party, but it's something that we're all doing this together, and the goal is to be real. To be real with ourselves and to be real with each other. And we discover what's most important to us together. By being real about our confusion and our intentions, we find wisdom together. And in Buddhism, wisdom always is followed by compassion and kindness. Whenever you see mention of wisdom, it always indicates compassion. You're right there with it. So it's one of the reasons why my favorite part of our meetings are the breakout groups, because you get a chance to hear what people are thinking, what everyone's thinking. So, and something similar happens in long sittings, which I recommend if you have the opportunity, where everyone in a long sitting, everyone to some extent, for those of you who've done Sesshin or done a long sitting, everyone comes apart. That's the nature of it, that to some extent, everyone, you get to see each other. And when you see each other in this vulnerable state, compassion and love for each other grows naturally. And it's often without a lot of talk, and it's a natural process. So in Sangha, we help each other by listening, and we take responsibility for our own lives together. And Zen is unique in that Zen is the only, what do I call it, faith, religion? I guess we can call it any of those. But Zen emphasizes face-to-face meeting, one-on-one, where we try to be as honest as we can and sincere as we can possibly be, whether it's as buddies, as peers, as with a teacher, and it can even happen on Zoom. How's that for amazing? So, one more thing I want to mention that hasn't been talked about a lot. Is for some of you see people wearing these Roksus, okay? And these are as my original sewing teacher used to say, Roksu is you take a perfectly good piece of cloth, you cut it up, and you sew it back together. But the thing about the Roksu that I think is so important is that the sewing of a Roksu, along with the study of the precepts, allows you to see a reflection of your mind with each stitch, with each time you sit down to sew. So if you're, the reason I'm mentioning this is I want to encourage you, if you're thinking about sewing, there are two bases of taking the precepts. One is studying the precepts as we're doing, but the second is sewing a Roksu. And wherever you are, there are teachers, it can be found that there's a teacher available, someone to help you sew, because no one can do this on their own. It's way too complicated to begin with. So I take refuge in Sangha as the interdependence of all creations. And I really believe that refuge is the Bodhisattva path, believing that we can help each other become who we really are, There's nothing to join, no membership card. It's just us. And Thich Nhat Hanh said something interesting, which is he said, the next Buddha is not going to be a person. The next Buddha, the coming Buddha, is the Sangha. So welcome to your Buddhahood. Thank you. So what
Thank
do I
you,
do?
Alan.
Ring the bell?
I think we'll take 1 minute of silence to reflect, and then I'll start.
Do we
Thank
ring
you.
The bell, Marianne?
Well, thank you, Alan, for the interpersonal reflection on Sangha. I think it's very good. My perspective on the precepts has been enriched lately by rereading Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass. She is a professor of botany at SUNY and a member of the Potawatomi tribe. Her book contains a lot of teachings from her elders about relationships to lands, plants, and the environment around us. Right along with this, I've also been reading The Light Eaters by Zoe Schranger, which is a deep dive into plant life and the questions about plants having consciousness, intelligence, and intention. This sentence will undoubtedly send alarm bells ringing in anyone trained in science. The subject has been taboo, a real career ender for 3 or 4 decades, ever since the publication of The Secret Life of Plants. In 1973, it was much more anecdotal and not based on hard science and rigorous testing. Now these conclusions are based on real science, and even though research papers and researchers are careful how they couch their findings, the conclusions are unavoidable. Now the precepts, from my perspective, are not instructions, such as commandments or rules. They are a compass, not a map. Keeping them in mind, you can check your intentions with this moral compass. When I take refuge in Sangha, I'm unable to separate it out from everything else due to our absolute interconnectedness. As John said in taking refuge in the Buddha, nothing is left out of our connectiveness. Thus, I perceive the three precepts as one: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, all intertwined. We as Westerners are trained to think of things as separate. We try and break things down to separate, distinct parts, to be studied and broken down to their smallest constituent bits. I'm attempting to reverse my university training, to see things now as a gestalt experience, a wholeness. The 10 prohibitory precepts are also perceived as one. If you break one, you actually break all of them due to their being part of a greater whole. I love our Sangha, the one in which we usually think of you and you and you. But I also see Sangha in a more animistic way. My scientific friends get very excited when someone starts anthropomorphizing, the Disneyfication of everything. They really skirt around assigning personhood to plants and trees, etc. Trying to describe how trees talk to each other without assigning words denoting personhood, comprehension, or communication, or recognition. Now, new research backed by rigorous testing actually shows how trees communicate through giving off pheromones from their leaves and sending messages through mycorrhizal networks from root systems. Not just trees either. All plant communities communicate through their leaves, roots, and hyphae. All flourishing is mutual. A tree can detect when it is under attack, say from bark beetles, and warn others to throw up their defense mechanisms. So when I consider Sangha, I'm considering everything around me, and I'm searching for ways to have a give and take, a reciprocal relationship with Sangha. Again, everything is interconnected. The word alone has no meaning in a forest. It is important to me to have an ecological compassion. To quote Suzuki Roshi from Branching Streams, there's no way to understand things by explaining them individually. This is just an intellectual description. We must have an actual feeling for it as well. Later, he says the way we should understand the relationship between us is illustrated by a poem. The mother is the blue mountain, and the children are the white clouds. All day long they are together, yet they do not know who is the mother and who are the children. So, even though they know very well. So well that they don't know. It's like having the actual feeling for it, as well as that he just said. This refers to our taking refuge in the great Sangha. Suzuki Roshi also says, in Not Always So, when you are encouraged by everything, and you realize everything is always helping you, then there's no difference whether you are dead or alive. This is recognizing the greater Sangha. Kōbun Chino once taught me the same thing that Kimmerer talks about in Braiding Sweetgrass. It's about Native tribes' relationship to the land. He once taught, in regards to owning land, you can never really own land. You just inherit the responsibility to caretake the land. This is our Sangha reciprocity, our ecological compassion. Back in Dogen's time, the Japanese had widespread belief in kamis, that is, the spirits that inhabit trees, plants, even rocks. It is spelled K-A-M-I. It was a recognition that everything is more than it seems, that there are spirits that make what we think of as things are more alive than we know. When I became a Buddhist more than 50 years ago, I was a young man who thought of myself as a stone with a lot of rough edges. I'm thinking about Alan's tumbler. I plunged into the stream of Buddhism, hoping to wear down those rough edges. You may come to your own conclusions. So every morning, I take refuge in the flourishing forest and everything in my environment as my Sangha, my community. Taking refuge as in welcoming and embracing with eyes wide open. This flourishing needs to be reciprocated. This is a big theme in Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass. Reciprocity is now my perception of the precepts. It has become a big part of my bodhisattva intention on kindness and compassion. It requires one to be awake, very aware, so as really to see reality. As a Sangha, we have many ceremonies which do more than just bring us together to celebrate, say, the full moon to renew our commitments. The power of ceremony for indigenous people is that it marries the mundane to the sacred. like a ceremony for harvest time. As Buddhists, we might think of ceremony as focusing attention so that attention becomes intention. In a recent lecture of Norman's, he said, "When we pay attention to our perception, we remain stable and sane." Since we're coming up to a big election in a few days, he also said that we need stability, confidence, and hope to survive. I repeat this because if we take refuge in Sangha, we are able to have that stability, confidence, and hope. In his lecture on Simon Weil, he pointed out that paying attention is the most important thing we can do in our spiritual life. And I am pointing out the importance of this in taking refuge in the greater Sangha. I'd like to read you a poem, an example of a feeling for Sangha from an anthology of indigenous people's poetry called "When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through." Now, the poem I'm going to read is by Christo Amemomini, just 2 years older than myself, and it is called "Ceremony for Completing a Poetry Reading." This is a giveaway poem. You've come gathering, made a circle with me of the places I've wandered. I give you the first daffodil opening from earth I've sown. I give you the warm loaves of bread baked in soft mounds like breasts. In this circle, I pass each of you a shell from our mother sea. Hold it in your spirit. Hear the stories she'll tell you. I've wrapped your faces around me, a warm robe. Let me give you ribbon work leggings, dresses sewn with elk teeth, moccasins woven with red and sky blue porcupine quills. I give you blankets woven of flowers and roots. Come closer, I have more to give. This basket is very large. I've stitched it with your kind words. Here is a necklace of feathers and bones, a sacred meal of chokeberries. Take this mask of bark, which keeps out the evil ones. This basket is only the beginning. There's something in my arms for all of you. I offer this memory of sunrise seen through ice crystals. Here, an afternoon of looking into the sea from high rocks. Here, a red-tailed hawk circles over our heads. One of her feathers drops for your hair. May I give you this round stone, which holds an ancient spirit? This stone will soothe you. Within this basket is something you've been looking for all your life. Come, take it. Take as much as you need. I give you seeds of a new way. I give you the moon shining on a fire of singing women. I give you the sound of our feet dancing. I give you the sound of our thoughts flying. I give you the sound of peace moving into our faces and stirring down. Come. This is a giveaway poem. I cannot go home until you have taken everything and the basket which held it. When my hands are empty, I will be full. I think that's a lovely poem. Reciprocity in taking refuge in Sangha can take many forms. Paying attention is a form of reciprocity with the living world, receiving the gifts with open eyes and open heart. having the best response to others. Everyone finds their own way. There is only being. Thank you very much.
Alan, maybe ring a bell for the minute of silence, and when it's done.
Alexa, turn it off.
And I'm gonna, but go ahead. So Alan and let's see, Alan and Jeff, do you have a question that you'd like the group to be thinking of when will they go in a moment into their into the breakout groups?
Yes, I think if we just ask ourselves what Sangha means to us, and what is your take on Sangha? We've offered a lot of different things here for you to think about. So I think, you know, we can speak to anything about that.
Does that sound good? Anything to add, Alan?
That's good.
Okay. So